David Dower is a piano player, a composer, a world traveler, and he has a new recording out. And we are happy to say he is our special guest on this episode of the Australian Jazz and Groove Podcast. Welcome back to another episode of the Australian Jazz and Groove Podcast. My name is David Galea, and it's great to be back in the saddle once again after a long break from doing the podcast. Now, since the last episode, there has been, as you may have seen, a mountain of great original Australian jazz music coming out, and it's just good to be back listening to it and being able to showcase some of this music on this episode and hopefully on other episodes to come very soon. So, let's get straight into it. What do we have to look forward to on this episode? Well, as we mentioned at the outset, we will be talking to Melbourne-based pianist and composer David Dower. He has a new recording out entitled Mravka, which he will be talking to us about. We'll also hear a new track from Melbourne singer and composer Michelle Nicole. She has a new album out on Earshift Records. But to start off, let's hear a track released back in 2017 from Melbourne group The Senangambian Jazz Band. Now, this band has been described on their Bandcamp page as a high-energy musical journey that takes the listener from the traditional West African melodies on the kora, which you may not know is a 21-string West African instrument, with deep drum rhythms through to modern jazz and funk. Now, the band's Bandcamp page also went on to say that the songs are composed by Amadou Souzo and sung in his native Mandinka. They tell stories of love, the band members' home countries, orphaned children, and inspiration found living in a new city. Throughout the album, Amadou Souzo's contemporary mastery of the kora provides a link to the traditions of his forefathers through his modern melodies. So that information was taken from their Bandcamp page, and I'm not sure if they're still together, but I was just so captivated by the sound when I discovered this band that they have created, with the different instrumentations, with so many genres coming together to create this unique sound. So I hope you really like it as much as I did. So here is our first track. It's the Senangambian Jazz Group and a track from their self-titled album. And it's a track called Hoku Fumo Talk.
Thank you. חמוד מאגם חמוד באב חמוד כן 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 מול 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 כזה מודו אמנה לכל מתג'ה
So that was Melbourne band, the Senangambian Jazz Band, and that track was called Hoku Fumo Talk. And if you want to learn more about this group, I found a great documentary. It's about 10 minutes long, and I searched it up on YouTube, and it talks about all the players in this group, their background, and the story behind this music. It's fascinating to check out. Well, now we've come to our guest artist for this episode, the very talented and articulate Mr. David Dower. Now, David is a pianist, a composer, and he specializes in original jazz and contemporary music, and he has performed widely throughout the UK, Bulgaria, Ireland, France, Malaysia, and throughout Australia. Now, he currently lives in Melbourne and has recently released a new recording that was inspired by his many trips to Bulgaria. So to hear a bit of what David does, let's listen to the title track of his latest release, and this is a track called Mravka. And then we will welcome him to the Australian Jazz and Groove Podcast.
Thank you.
David Dow, welcome to the Australian Jazz and Groove Podcast.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
It's fantastic to have you on the podcast. And being a fellow South Gippslandian, I think that's what we can call ourselves.
Gippslander. I might have gone with Gippslander.
A Gippslander. And you're in Melbourne at the moment and have just put out a new recording, which we'll talk about very soon. But what got you into jazz and particularly into composing jazz music?
Yeah, I started piano lessons with a guy on my street in Foster, which is in South Gippsland, and he famously couldn't read bass clef very well. So he was kind of a stride pianist, essentially. And from the age of six, that's what I learned, which was kind of fortunate because I don't think I have the concentration span to nail a great Bach fugue or something.
Yep.
So his whole thing was like, here's a piece, what can you add to it? Which is just a very lucky introduction as a young kid. And then when I went to high school, I went to a school in Melbourne and they had a jazz piano teacher there, Howard Belling, who's the father of Fem Belling, the Melbourne-based jazz singer. And 6 years hanging out with him and just talking about chords, which was just, So that was kind of how I got started on it, which then led to just jumping into university and pursuing it at Monash Uni and Whopper in Perth. Studying with people like Steve Settergreen and Tom O'Halloran and Mark Hannaford. That was kind of the education side of it. So it was just kind of a happenstance that my teacher's limitation was kind of an opening.
That's awesome to know that, because traditionally people learn scales, they learn to read music, they learn the classical repertoire, but you were thrown straight into almost an improvisational setting. Is that correct? Is that how you would explain it or describe
it? Pretty much. Very like chord symbols straight away.
Wow.
Like, you know, you had to know just that was melody and chord symbols and what can you do with your left hand and how can you self-accompany. My grandma was really into all those old war songs. So yeah. And they all play kind of stride piano. So, you know, you get that buzz of your grandma saying, oh, I really like when you play side by side with that stride piano thing. And you kind of, I don't know, that kind of makes you excited to do it more. And so it became a bit of a party trick at high school, doing it as fast, stride piano as fast as you could. It probably sounded horrific, but at the time, my 13-year-old mates were super impressed.
Wow, impressing 13-year-olds with stride piano. That's pretty that's pretty unheard of.
If you put it that way, it does sound funny.
That's cool. But how awesome to... So when it came to improvising, did you not have that sort of tentativeness there that maybe a younger student that's come from a classical background would have had?
Yeah, I think there was just this kind of... I guess it was like a bit of a reckless abandon. But it probably was quite hacky in many ways. But what was cool was that my teacher let it happen. There was no, that's not quite right or whatever. When I got to high school, I played something to my teacher and he said, oh, you know, his first comment was, we can work with this. So he was the one after 6 years of doing what I want and just really mucking around that kind of started to hone things in with more like scale chord relationships and stuff. So that's necessary, but I'm really glad I had this kind of muck around childhood, which I guess is how I started composing as well. He was all for just write your own song. He never told me to write my own song or never forced me to and never edited what I did. But if I brought him a song I did, he'd say, that's great. This week, that's your practice. Just write another one or keep playing that one, which was really cool because I know that, you know, lots of people's experience of music teachers is they go, oh, that's great. Now back to accent on achievement, you know, back to what we were doing. Here's the metronome 10-year-old, which is, I guess it has its place, but it wouldn't have suited my kind of all over the shop approach to it, which, yeah.
That's awesome because I know as a parent wanting to teach my children and not wanting to sort of jam it down their throat, so to speak, I sort of feel myself falling into that pattern of like, let them just muck around for a bit. And to be able to hear that is not necessarily the worst grounding in the world is quite encouraging, actually.
Yeah. And I think the big thing for me was that I was never told off for playing the piano as a kid. So the piano was in a different room. You can hear it from where the TV is, but I was never told to stop.
Yeah, right.
Except if it was, you know, too late or sometimes, you know, too early in the morning. Yep. But very rarely told off for playing. And I just know that I reckon that's just having that always positive association with it, you know. And I used to play drums as well, and I was never told off for playing drums.
Wow.
Which is bold parenting, you know, because they would have been suffering. But very lucky, because I think that always having that positive association with it is a great motivator for any student, really.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, so at what age did you start to write music? Did you, as your teacher said, you didn't discourage you. So was it young in your like musical life that you'd start writing, just putting things down or in your head?
Yeah, I wrote a song at 10, and I can still play it, which is bizarre. I think my teacher recorded some of them, so then you know I can kind of refresh what it was, and it's fine. It's fine. It's not bad. Yeah. And then at 11, I wrote another one that was full of arpeggios. I think I just learned some arpeggios.
Yep.
And my grandma loved it, so she claimed it. So
yeah,
she
decided
it was called Grand Song. And that kind of started the thing for me of you can write songs for people, even though I actually hadn't for her. She'd kind of decided that was hers. And that led to some nice moments, like when my grandpa was quite sick. I was about 14 and Gran said, why don't you write him a song? And
yeah,
I got to play him that song, which is probably just a simple, you know, 2-minute child ballad. But it's sort of that really, again, just that extremely positive association with this can mean more. It's more than just notes. Like, there are people around me going, this is, that's magical.
Mm.
And giving me that association that, oh, this is meaningful beyond just learning songs. And so I think, same thing, I suppose, just that really positive association of the piano and of mucking around with the piano and of writing something for the piano. And it's pretty cool. I'm sort of only just realizing how cool that is right now, actually.
I'm really glad I could be here for the moment.
I feel like my psychologist.
well, I have a lounge room. No, I was just going to say too, well, because that element of composing, that part is the vital part, no matter how advanced you are in compositional techniques or and how much you know about composing, that element is the thing that should always be there. That thing of, this means something for someone or for me, it's based on something. Does that make sense?
I had a student years ago who'd written a song, and it was a little bit it was pretty abstract, and I didn't want to be the fire blanket on his creative expression, but all I said after hearing it was, you know, what's this called? Like, oh, I don't know yet. Okay. Oh, he was a uni student. And I was like, okay, what's it about? Or who's it for? Or is it anything? Nah, you know, I just got some licks from the Sleminsky's Thesaurus of Scales and Patterns and shoved them in there. And I think I didn't say this at the time. I just sort of went, okay. But I think I was disappointed that that was like possible. Like, not that it's, I think as an exercise, it's fine. But to have nothing to even, like, why wouldn't you go, oh, it's about chaos. About the entropy of existence, you know, at least you have something. It can be chaos. Oh, it's about the Sleminsky Thesaurus of Scales and Melodic Patterns, you know. It's a dedication to this book of exercises. Like, that's fine, but something. I couldn't believe that this person was writing a piece about nothing. And like, you don't need a title necessarily, but just, I think, just having a framework. And I know that there's that great book by Steve Nachmanovich called Free Play, and he says for free improvising, it's usually helpful, it can be helpful to have two parameters. So it might be traffic and D major, and with those, even though it's like a tunnel, you're not, like, if you look at the vast expanse of the sky, it's kind of endless, but if you've got the tunnel, you've got a direction. And so I think that's what I like about for songwriting, having some purpose, and letting that take you where it takes you.
Yeah, that's awesome. So when you write now, do you sort of set some parameters? So do you think, well, I want to write something, or, you know, is it an event? Is it a person still? Or do you just sometimes have the desire to write something and you think, well, I'm going to set some parameters in which I'm going to write, like you said, chaos with D major, or it could be, you know, I'm going to write a song that's, you know, this was what happened in the news today, so I'm going to try and write something about that. How does that process for you go?
Yeah, well, I think so, especially for this last album, I knew I wanted to record this album that really heavily referenced the Bulgarian thing, which I suppose we should explain to people at some point. But so that was one big parameter, was I'm going to be in Bulgaria again. I'm going to have access to these Bulgarian musicians. So I reckon that's a huge parameter immediately. That just directed all the energy that way. And then inside of that, you can do anything.
Yeah.
And some of the tunes on the album aren't Bulgarian. Some of them are, you know, but there was that, I guess that overarching heading or theme, or that color of hue of paint was ready to go.
Yeah.
Rather than having every color, you know, and being confused about which one to use first, I think.
Yeah, because we will get to that right now, because the last three albums you've recorded have been recorded in Bulgaria. And I've, just from my association with you over the last few years, you know, Dave's back in Bulgaria again. Dave's back in Bulgaria. And so can you just explain the connection that you've got with that country, how that came about, and then what's been the product of that association you've got with Bulgaria?
It's been a wild ride, I would say. I used to live in London, and I used to play with an Australian bass player named Luke Fowler, who's been in London for a long time now, and a British drummer. And we had a residency at Luke Fowler's venue. And Luke, back in the day, was in a world music band and brought in a Bulgarian traditional wedding dance song called Gankino Horo, which is in 11. And I've never, you know, Bulgarian music was mentioned at uni, but in kind of a sterile, you know, one world music lecture. And I sort of, it sort of just went in one ear and out the other. But then actually learning a song, super cool, and trying to perform it. And it was probably shaky and awful. It was just a quiet residency in a pub, you know. I was just invigorated. And we'll hang out afterwards. And I think we joked about touring there. And we drank quite a bit. And I went home. I took an Uber home, sat down about 2 a.m. and emailed two venues. I just got on Facebook and went Bulgarian Jazz Club and found two. And they were, when I woke up, they both said, yeah,
wow,
we'd love to have you. And so we went. The first gig, there was 50 people there. I don't know why.
That's cool.
I don't know why anyone came. It was in the capital city. Sadly, that venue's not there anymore, but there was an upright piano. They'd borrowed a drum kit from someone.
Wow.
That's a bass amp. And the crowd, it was the most incredible experience. Like, I remember the reaction was amazing, overwhelming. Like, they loved it. They wrote on every note. And like, between solos, no one applauded. And I remember asking someone afterwards why, and they said, oh no, we know you're supposed to, but if we did, we'd miss the next solo.
Wow, that's cool.
Like, just this really, cool. You know, and one woman came up to me afterwards and said, thank you for playing. I didn't enjoy it. And,
and wow.
It was like, oh my God. And I spoke to another person afterwards who said, that doesn't mean she wasn't happy to be here.
Yep.
It's like if you go to an art museum and art museum? That's right, right? Yeah. Thank you. It's like if you go to an art gallery and you don't like the painting, but it was still a nice night out.
Hmm.
But you experience the art. And so I think she saw it from go to woe and thought about it and went, okay, yeah, nah, not for me. Hmm. Which is kind of, it's more lovely than, you know, I guess leaving or yelling out play horses, you know, it has a much more endearing artistic quality. And that's happened a few times. Not that many people have said they've disliked it, but the people that have, the occasional people, now I understand what they're saying.
Yep.
And it's actually quite sweet because they never leave.
Yeah.
It's really lovely. So hold on, where have I gone? Okay. So at that first gig, there was a woman there named, her Facebook name is Mary Derry, and that's what we still call her. But her real name is Mariana Vasileva. And she sat us down and had a big chat and was the friendliest person ever. We're still in touch today. That was 2017.
Wow.
And she organized the next year for us to play at a festival.
Okay.
And it's a Bansko International Jazz Festival, which was televised. It was played on national radio. It still repeats our concert, our performance.
Very cool.
Apparently it's been seen one or two times a year. There was 3,000 people in the audience, grand piano, all this stuff. Wow. We had no idea how big it was until we pretty much were driven to the stage.
That's so cool.
And it was just TV cameras. And so it's on YouTube, the whole concert. Nice. And that was all because of Mary.
Mary Derry
just saved us. She
That's so cool.
And she was she's been a big supporter, a huge friend. She's my, you know, go-to for any cultural information I need.
Yep.
She's the best. She's driven all over Bulgaria to come and hang out with us. Nice. She picks up merchandise that we get printed there and delivers it to us. I owe her a lot of money.
Right.
Just in terms of her moral support.
Yeah, of course.
So she is my lyricist, which I think is the coolest thing. So the last two albums have had Bulgarian choirs, and my Bulgarian is limited, to say the least. So she has written me these amazing Bulgarian lyrics, which has been just an amazing experience to work with because it makes it so much more authentic.
Yeah.
Having Bulgarian, proper Bulgarian lyrics. And then I guess there's the compositional challenge of I then have to place those lyrics on, you know, on Sibelius, the notation program, and then record a demo of me singing it in Bulgarian. So there's been a few moments when we've got to the studio and the way I've phrased the lyrics has sounded like, I guess a good example is like saying, someone saying Subaru instead of Subaru.
Okay, yep.
And so for me, I don't notice that it sounds weird, but the thing is, will pull me up on it.
Yes.
We're in the studio, you know, on the fly, moving phrases by whatever weird amounts just to, so that to the Bulgarian ear,
it's authentic.
It's authentic. So that's just meeting Mary at this first gig and becoming her friend has led to just a crazy amount of amazing positive things happening.
That connection with Bulgaria. I remember we were talking a little while ago and you were just talking about the caliber of musicians that are in Bulgaria. What was that like to, you know, you were talking about the studio and the caliber of musicians, not that you were surprised, but it was just, you know, it was something that you thought was just awesome. Did you want to talk a bit more about that?
There's something, maybe it's because teaching in Bulgaria doesn't pay very well, but performing, I think, might. I'm not exactly sure on the financial details of it, but I know that teaching doesn't.
Right.
And so I guess there's more of a need to perform.
Yep.
Like if you want to make a financial choice in Australia, you go, well, I'll probably teach. You need, that's how you pay your rent. But that option sort of doesn't exist. So if you want to be a musician, you're more likely to really refine your craft.
Wow.
And so it's led to this kind of incredible batch of students, an incredible batch of, there's an amazing set of kind of, I don't know what the word is, older, middle-aged musicians kind of leading the education of it all and the guidance. But the playing is incredible, absolutely incredible.
You can hear it on the album, which we'll get to in a minute, but yeah, you can definitely hear it in there.
Yeah. And I've definitely sort of gone to jams in Bulgaria. There's a lot of jamming going on, which is great, and just been blown away. Like you'll have some Bulgarian 18-year-old pianist just sounds like Oscar Peterson.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely shredding, unbelievable, you know. And they seem to have a great eagerness to put in the work, and they aspire, have like huge aspirations and really love it. Which is just, I don't know why I didn't expect it, But it's just really visible. And lots of, weirdly, an amazing R&B scene.
Wow. Okay. Just
an incredible R&B scene. And there's some, we've come across like world-beating bass players who release albums under their own name of R&B stuff, you know, and I don't know. It's just been a surreal thing. So the musicians we've worked with on the album have been super professional. They turn up fully organized. The Kaval player especially, which is the Kaval is like a traditional Bulgarian instrument that's like a, it's like a black recorder flute crossover kind of thing. But it's
Wondered if that, I was going to ask you about the Kaval because I heard it on the recent album, which I'll get you to pronounce in a minute because I don't want to wreck the pronunciation of that album. But I wanted you to talk about the Kaval and particularly the musician that was playing it on the album because it's just beautiful. I think it's the second or third track and just a standout of the album to me. Yeah.
Well, it's just this thousands of year old instrument and he is a master. An absolute master. His name is Zhivko Vasilev. He's probably, I don't want to guess his age. I think he's my age. I think he's about 30, 33.
Young fella.
And so he studied his masters of music in Rotterdam playing jazz on the Kaval, but the Kaval itself doesn't play all 12 tones.
Okay.
I think it's missing two, but he's worked out alternate fingerings and omniture things to make, to be able to play chromatic music. So he was, he's on his, you know, social media, he'll post shredding bebop scales, like shredding bebop solos, transcriptions on this instrument that if I picked it up and played all 10 notes, it does, you know, like just the depth of skill is so self-evident, you know, when you hear him play. And so he came in and, you know, he's played on the last two albums I've done, and both times it's like he'll do a perfect take and then he'll ask if he can do another one because I'm fine with the first take. Just has like it, because it can play microtonally, it has this beautiful, it can be shrill like a flute, or it can be have a very wide, warm, breathy timbre that's kind of, it's really hard to describe, but it's so dense, this other sound, and to oscillate between them and different overtone effects. And then it has a percussive mode, which he uses a couple of times where he, with breath, makes it like, it's almost like a drum, but like, it's like an unpitched, breathy drum, like almost like beatboxing or something.
Wow.
I'm infatuated with the instrument. And he's from watching his stuff on social media, he's taking over Europe basically. He's festivals all over the country, all over the continent, and in various amazing projects. And
you said he played on your last two albums. So was it a matter of you went to Bulgaria the first time and then you found this, like you, or did someone put you onto him, or how did that connection
friends
happen?
With Mary Derry.
Mary Derry's friend.
Everyone's friends with Mary Derry. But
wow.
The choir and the choir that I use is led by his sister.
Okay.
Who's Mary Derry's friend.
Right. Yep. Did she come out to your gig because it was like a traveling and she was just checking them out, or did she just happen to be there, or how did you get to be with Mary?
It was for some reason advertised as a jam session, which it absolutely wasn't.
Yeah.
And she worked in the area and she saw the sign and thought, oh, I'll come watch a jam session.
Wow.
And then, you know, she asked if it was a jam session. I said no, and she was disappointed. This is before we played.
Yeah.
And then I asked her what she played and she said nothing. She
wanted to hear a jam session.
Yeah. Just because it's cool. And she's a big music fan and
She has these connections with all these people. Like
I guess she's just somehow made friends with these amazing musicians.
Yeah. Wow.
What's Malcolm Gladwell would call her a connector, or a, you know, like in terms of like there's a, you know, a socialite almost.
Yep. A jazz socialite.
Yeah. Yeah. So
yep.
A lot of it comes back to just the lucky circumstance that this amazing person was there that night and was on board.
Well, it really comes back to that tune that Luke brought to the gig that was the Bulgarian, and that sort of led to that. So coming now down to the album, can you just, how do you pronounce the name of the album before I record? So,
I was nervous about calling it a Bulgarian word because of this moment, but I chose a word that I thought was phonetic enough that most people could say it. So Mravka.
Mravka. Okay. Mravka. Yep.
Which means ant.
Which is what the reference to the artwork on your album, which is awesome. Well, I love it, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Some people, it's good. It's one of those artworks that some people don't like, which I kind of into that too. Like, I like the fact that it's memorably contentious. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just some people just, I don't know. I guess most ECM jazz albums are like shadowy rivers and stuff. So
that's correct.
A little bit unusual to have.
Or blurry clouds or something.
So it's a little bit unusual to have this like really cool cartoon of a sad ant playing chess by itself. And my friend from Gippsland, from Lake's Entrance, Jesse Kidd, is the artist. And I did the rough drawing. That's what I wanted, but he brought it to life. And I love how it's a bit like, there's a bit of a juxtaposition of, it's kind of a comical ant and it's kind of a sad scene. And there's something kind of, I think it reflects the music quite well of it's sort of sad, happy, I think. If that makes any sense at all. Or sometimes it's overtly like silly almost. I don't want to talk down my music, but it's got this energy of fun, but then it's quite emotional too at the same time.
So listening to the album, I could hear that in there, because you know, one minute you're playing like a beautiful ostinato piano part, and then all of a sudden there'll be a distorted bass come in, and then,
Ben Folds influence.
So you've got like, I think I read somewhere you sort of call it like singer-songwriter jazz and then you've just smashed it into this Bulgarian culture at the same time, and then you've add the kaval, and so a lot of people would go, well, how does that work? But when you listen to it, you go, okay, I can hear that it works. So I suppose the artwork sort of features it. It's not what you expect, you know. It's sort of definitely a if you did see an ECM type picture, you'd have an expectation in your mind of what it should be, but totally. It doesn't fit that ECM in that, and that's not disrespectful. It's got ECM elements, but it does, but also has folk elements. It has rock elements. It has, you know, pop feel to it. So was that a deliberate way of writing, or was that just from you being exposed to all these different forms of music and you're in Bulgaria? How did that come about?
I think it's kind of a sound that I've been aiming for a little while, and it is a lot of my influences sort of adding up. I probably played the wrong instrument, really. I probably should have been some sort of weird rock guitarist, you know. So the fuzz bass is just like one of my favorite sounds. And especially in that controlled setting of an album, where the way we did it for the nerds out there is it's just a big muff pedal, the bass one. And we had a dry out and a wet out, so the affected one and the non-affected one. And the engineer afterwards, Brody Stewart in Perth, who's just a wizard, you know, just faded in the distortion as much as he felt.
Just blended the two, did he?
Moment suited. Which means there's sometimes that it's just on a bit and the bass has just got a little bit of a sparkly distorted element. Sometimes it's ramped to come out like a lead guitar. But in the studio, we just turned it on and off. That mixing of it, I think, is gives it sort of a really emotive depth that maybe people might not associate with a fuzz pedal. But when it's blended like that and controlled, I think it's super cool. It adds a lot to the jazz piano genre. I know ECM did a little bit of distorted double bass, and I'm not sure if other jazz, there must be other jazz piano trios doing it, but I haven't really come across it a great deal.
And that's the thing that
I'd love to be corrected if people do know. I'd love to find out if people are doing it, because I think it's awesome.
Yeah, I really loved it because being a bass player too, it's not something that I have been traditionally taught to gravitate towards, but I'm hearing it more and more. And I do love it on double bass, and I love that. And I think in the context that you put it in, it was like a perfect context to have it in. And I think because the other thing I was going to ask about the piano is, even though you've got these choirs and you've got these other instruments, it seems like the piano is still a dominant sound, but not in an overpowering way. It still sounds like it's your sound. So was that just from the studio? Was that a deliberate, or was that just because as a trio you've honed that sound?
I think the third. I think we've just honed that sound. And actually as I get older, I would say, and this is not the right word, floor is not the right word, but it's probably a crutch of my writing is like, I have to play everything because I write it that I can play everything.
Yep.
And it's, this album actually is my best effort at sort of letting go of the piano playing everything. So in the studio, we did the trio stuff on one day and everything else on the second day.
Wow.
So I had to, it was quick. It was really quick. And I had to play in a way that I knew, okay, there's people singing here. I'm not playing the melody.
Mm.
You know, I'm not playing the bass notes. I'm not playing that bass line. Mm. Like I'm part of a band, which I can do if I'm not the band leader. But when it's my stuff, it's very much like, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's just because I've written it.
Mm.
I guess I'd struggle to be a composing drummer. Because I wouldn't be able to play everything. but I'm getting better at letting go. And I reckon the next thing I do, I want to let go even more and have even have some moments where the piano has some rest.
Is it that age causes you to let go more? Like, is it wisdom? Is it maturing ears? Is it that confidence where you're willing to just give it to someone else? Or compositionally, you've got a different sound in your head? I don't know. What would it be?
Probably all of that, really.
Yeah.
I feel like as well, as I get older, I realize piano is a because I love the piano. It's like, that's my favorite thing.
I think it's my favorite instrument, even though I don't play it.
It's just been my favorite forever, you know, just forever. It's just, it's what I like doing. And I like my master's degree was on solo piano, you know, so it's very like the piano can do it all. And I think the older I get and the more I've sort of started learning some bass and guitar, and so I've sort of realized, oh, these instruments bring a lot. You know, and I had a friend from London overdubbed some guitar on this album. Elliot Frost is his name. He just released a great album as well last week. And when his parts came on, it was just like, oh my God, like now it wouldn't make sense without his parts.
Yeah.
Even though none of the demos I made have guitar, and it just, and I think I'm just realizing more and more, maybe the piano can't do it all. And maybe I could go even further and remove the piano and still have my voice on it, which I think comes down to like trusting the musicians you play with and them knowing your style. And I think what I love about playing with Matt Fisher and Luke Fowler, who are the London musicians who still do the tours and do the albums, is they know what I want and they'll jump to it really quickly, which is sort of, you know, we don't really get arguing about whatever, you know. It's just like, okay, yeah, we'll do it, and not begrudgingly, I hope. And then Brody, who mixes it, knows the sound I want, so I think finding that voice, but having it supported by the people around you to make it exist, and then I guess learning to trust that more and more, so that might lead to more backing away, if that makes sense.
It totally makes sense because often, even though haven't done a podcast for a while, but often on the podcast we talk about that whole band mentality, and listeners might be sick of hearing about it, but it's definitely there. Like it, and this is the next stage on from that, I think, because when you hear an album that's played, performed by a band, that's a band, you can hear it. But then when the composer trust continues to release music with that band, that trust deepens and they do back away a bit. And so I think that that band thing is so important. And I can imagine you would have felt that, particularly even when you go on tour, to know that you've got those guys, they've got your back. Is that how you think that's another element to the album, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's funny. I think this is part of growing up as well. I remember I was in a little group when I was 20, and the sax player got angry one day at me. We'd been drinking, I think, and he got angry at me because I had to learn this ostinato in my left hand and solo over it. And because we'd done a few gigs and rehearsed it a lot, he got angry that my solos over it weren't that inventive every time. Wow. Yeah, look, and I guess that's just like the naivety of, yeah, your facial reaction was exactly how I felt, like confused. Yeah. You know, like I'd practiced a few things that I could nail for a gig and wanted to get them down, and I was pretty young and inexperienced. But I think there's that, you know, you're at uni and you're being told, be inventive, you know, colors and change it up. And I think that actually what's really beautiful is knowing someone's licks, playing with someone so much that you could, you know how they play, you know what's coming. And that way you can play with them, you know. And there's a great quote from a Melbourne drummer whose name is escaping me right now, which is like, you got to make the obvious feel unexpected and the unobvious feel expected.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you know someone's soloing lick, you know, that should be not obvious.
Mm.
But if you can catch on to it, that's really exciting.
Mm.
And if you're playing obvious stuff, you know, if you can make that exciting somehow, you know, so you make the cliches exciting and, if that makes any sense at all.
Well, it does, because, you know, when we talk to each other, we get to know someone as a person. We know that we sort of understand how they're about to express themselves. So we can, if we know them well enough, we can either push that button, we could accept what they're about to say, or we could challenge them in another way. Like it's purely a conversational thing. So yeah, and improvisation in playing jazz is very much a conversation. So having an idea of what someone's going to say is not a bad thing, because you could then do something with it yourself. Yes. Like you can actually challenge them because you know what they're going to say, or you kind of have an understand how that, it's like with drummers, you sort of know what they're going to do. and then you can push them as a bass player. I love that, you know, being able to, you know, have fun that way, you know. So I don't think it's a bad thing.
Yeah. I love that on tour with these two guys, we would make fun of, like, you know, the whole, like, yeah, who am I? Like, you know, and everyone would know, like, in the band that that's a Matt Fisher drum lick or whatever. And it was, it's, I think that's cooler than being like, the nicest thing about you guys is I have no idea what you're going to do. Like, you're like a band. And I know that, you know, you've got that whole amazing thing of Herbie Hancock and Ron Carter. And what was, I think, I might be telling tales out of school, but I think they called it the Red Book, which is where they wrote down heaps of variations on 2/5s.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And then they would try them. So they would just sit and just like we're talking now, no instruments, talk about 2/5/1 options and then play them behind Miles.
Yep.
And get a band sound and experiment and explore. And I think the best way to come to those realizations, whether it's through a discussion or just orally, is through touring and just being open to it and, you know, not telling someone off for maybe being slightly predictable.
Dave, it's been awesome having you on the podcast. How can people get in touch with your music? How can they buy the latest album?
Through Bandcamp. Yep. So David Dowell Trio, Bandcamp. You can purchase it, which is always nice. And I actually have a few CDs and vinyl, and they're just nice. They're coming out of the shop in Caulfield where I live. My website has a contact page, which is daviddowellmusic.com or daviddowell@gmail.com, and just ask for a vinyl and I'll post one your way. There's not many left. I didn't make many vinyls because it was a bit of an experiment, sort of well received, because it'd be cooler than a CD, I suppose. I suppose a CD goes in a drawer and a vinyl you might put up on the wall. That's how you find it all. And the YouTube video of us playing David Dowell Trio at the Bansko International Jazz Festival is just worth a peek, just because we were as surprised as everyone else was that we were there.
That's awesome. Well, thanks so much again for being a part of the podcast, and we'll look forward to hearing the next album out of Bulgaria, hopefully soon.
Thanks so much, Dave. Cheers.
So a big thank you to David Dowell for sitting down with me many months ago now and talking to me about his musical journey and his latest release, Mravka, which, as he said, you can purchase on Bandcamp. So go do that, folks. Support these artists and show them your support by purchasing their music. Well, now we've come to a track from a recent release that has seriously blown my mind, and that is from Melbourne songstress and composer Michelle Nicole.
She has just released on Earshift Records a new album called The Bark Project. And quoting from her Bandcamp page, it says that The Bark Project richly embraces the music of J.S. Bach in their unique chamber-style jazz. The album integrates the art of interpretation, improvisation, and reimagines these masterworks. The quartet's arrangements showcase the mastery of J.S. Bach's compositions and add a new flavor to the improvisational elements found and sometimes lost in these great works. Now, the album features guitarist Jeff Hughes, bassist Tom Lee, and drummer Ronnie Farella. Now, this is the first track taken from the album, and the track is called March in D/Dionette. Michelle is quoted as saying that this is a piece I played as a young violinist. Being so familiar made shaping the phrases and extending the melody such a natural, freeing way to play this piece. Imagining how it would sound if one of our musical heroes, Ornette Coleman, were playing it. My favorite way to treat any melody, actually. So we've dubbed this March in D-Ornette. So please enjoy Michelle Nicole as she sings March in D-Ornette.
Lonely, Lord of Love. No, the lady, lady, love, the lady, love.
So that was Michelle Nicole and her rendition of March in D, or as she calls it, in D Ornette, from the Bark Project on Earshift Records. And as we mentioned earlier, folks, please go and buy this music. If you've heard on this podcast anything you like, then please purchase it. It's the best way that you can show your support for this music and help our artists continue to pour their heart and soul into these amazing compositions. Well, we've come to the end of another podcast, and I promise it won't be too long till the next one, which, by the way, will feature Melbourne jazz great and true gentleman, Mr. Jack Pantassis, stopping by to talk about his life in music and his latest release. So until next time, it's been great having your company. Please spread the word about the podcast, and until next time, it's bye for now.